Hello, and welcome to episode 227 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott. And Scott.
We're already entering the confusing stage of the show, because for the past few years, Rick and I have asked a guest to join us as we look ahead to the coming year. And this year, we're excited to welcome a special guest. Scott Milfred is the national opinion editor at Lee Enterprises, and he also co-hosts Center Stage, a podcast about politics and policy in Wisconsin. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Today, we'll each share two predictions for 2026, and at the end of the show, we'll take a quick look back to see how last year's forecasts held up. We have a long list of prognostications to get to, so let's get right at it. Rick, why don't you start us off? Tell us what your first prediction is for 2026.
I'm going to make an unusual prediction because I'm not at all a political analyst, but I'm going to predict something concerning politics this time, and that is that Pete Hegseth will be forced out as U.S. Secretary of War. I think as the investigations intensify into the Venezuelan boat strikes, I think that he's going to lose political support. My impression, he had already lost a lot of support within the Pentagon, and what's keeping him in place is popular support among the mega coalition, which, as we've seen, is starting to crumble. And I think as we move towards the midterms, that coalition is going to continue to crumble and Hegseth will be left without any support.
I should let listeners know that we are recording this the afternoon of December 15th, and it is not an impossibility that before this show comes out December 31st, that Rick's prediction may have already come true. So I guess we'll wait and see. But Scott, I'd be curious your thoughts on this. Certainly, as the second half of this year has gone along, the president has seen a pretty consistent drop in his approval rating. He would not be the first president who tries to reset the conversation after the first of the year by making some changes in his cabinet. What do you think of Rick's prediction?
It makes sense to me. And remember, the Donald Trump 1.0, his first term, he went through a lot of cabinet secretaries. He went through a lot of top people. And really, he hasn't so far. And he's almost a year in, which for him is a lot of stability, I think. So I could see him quickly dispatching of Hegseth, who would probably be the easiest to get rid of, other than maybe RFK Jr. is the other one who seems to be in some hot water. So far, it seems like Hegseth has kept his head above water on this one, but who's to say what's going to come out? And he seems to have a running sort of habit of causing some angst among moderate senators who seem to ever so slightly be stepping up and reestablishing their role of oversight.
Rick, you correctly cited this as Pete Hegseth, whose current position, I guess, is U.S. Secretary of War. I'll just put you on the spot before we move on to my prediction. Do you think that when the next administration comes around, we'll continuing to call this the Secretary of War, or do you think we will go back to, Secretary of War was what it was called, I think, through World War I, if my memory's right. But do you think that will stick longer than this current administration?
I think we'll probably move back to renaming a lot of things in the first week of the next administration, including Secretary of Defense, Gulf of Mexico, lots of things like that. But What I find kind of interesting about this is in Trump's first term, most of those appointees that he fired during the time were people who pushed back against him. Hegseth has not done that at all. And I don't know if he's ever let somebody go or push somebody out who has stood by him and done exactly what he wanted because of opposition from the outside. And so that will be interesting to see if that happens, if Hegseth becomes really the first person who gets removed because of outside pressure.
And of course, if that does happen, it'll be interesting to see who raises a hand and says they are interested in that job, if there's an opening.
I'm glad that Trump at least didn't call it the Department of Peace, which would have seemed Orwellian. At least Department of War has some factual basis behind it.
Well, we'll move on. As I said, we have a lot of predictions to get to. I will go next, and I will fully admit that this could very easily fall into a danger anyone makes when making predictions. This is what I strongly want to happen, so hopefully I can wish it into reality. But for those out there who are baseball fans, there is a loud warnings going on that this time next year, in fact, December 1st, 2026, owners across Major League Baseball will institute a lockout and begin another work stoppage in the game. This did happen 5 years ago, and players and owners were able to come to an agreement at the last second to avoid any games being lost. There has not been a long work stoppage in the sport since 1994, which ended really badly when the World Series ended up being canceled. I am just convinced, my prediction is that, kind of against the conventional wisdom at the moment, that players and owners will come to an agreement before the December 1st, 2026 deadline, because a year after that are some very important TV deals. And if there is anything we learn from the 1994 work stoppage, that it is not something fans embrace. It sends ratings down on TV. It hurts attendance at the ballpark. I think people will have, on both sides, will have an urgency to work together and get ahead of this. And so my prediction is that there will be a new contract signed in Major League Baseball for the next collective bargaining agreement on or before December 1st. Rick, Scott, am I just being too optimistic here?
As a baseball fan, I hope you're not being too optimistic. It makes sense to me. There's so much money now that I don't know why they would risk it, even if they don't get one side or the other exactly what they want.
But so I don't follow baseball as much as you guys do. So you seem to be saying because the financial stakes are higher, they're less likely to engage in this kind of conflict. I would think it would make it more likely.
I mean, the argument I guess I would make is that if you're expecting, you know, people like Amazon or Apple or the more conventional homes to sports like NBC and ESPN to open up their checkbooks wide and be willing to sign very long-term TV deals, that is very is a hard sell if you're coming out of an extended work stoppage that is going to demoralize fans across the country. And yeah, I think the argument is going to be of how to disperse that great amount of money that's going to come from these TV rights deals. And I don't want to make it sound easy, but I just think I would rather get 75 or 80% of a big pot of money versus 60 or 50% of a much shrinking, a much smaller pot of money, because I just think going into those deals saying, you know, well, we haven't had games for half of a season, but, you know, I'm sure fans won't notice. Give us a big contract here so we can have great ratings on your streaming service or your network, just seems to be a tough sell. And I don't think that is being thought about enough as people look into this. But I promise you, there's talk now that they're having some very early talks a year away from the deadline, but I anticipate that the pressure on that will ramp up. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll stop talking about baseball, is that we also just came out of a postseason that I think most fans would say was one of the better postseasons we've had. It was a fantastically interesting World Series. I just think it would be a huge mistake, and I think both sides realize it, to put some sort of work stoppage at the end of that situation. So I don't know. So you think I'm not being crazy, Scott?
I don't think you are. It's a different animal. But when you think about the NCAA, where they seem to be bending over backwards to just keep everything rolling forward, even though they have to start paying players, even though there's basically a lot of teams that are flouting some of the rules they have for contacting players in advance with their transfer portal. It seems like they just want to keep those big TV contracts rolling, and they're not going to stop that juggernaut.
I think you presented some really good reasons why it would be irrational for both sides not to come in agreement. I find that in a lot of negotiations, people do not act rationally. And what is much more important is the quality of leadership on both sides. And I don't know enough about the people involved, but I would say if there's good leadership, they'll come to an agreement. If there's poor leadership, no matter what the reasons are, they won't.
That's a good place to leave it. I think now we'll turn to our special guest, Scott Milfred, to make his first prediction of 2026.
Well, thanks. I think that the U.S. electric vehicle market will rebound sharply in 2026, hitting roughly 1.7 million units. Just for comparison, it's probably going to be about 1.4 million this year. After a late 2025 slump driven by the end of the $7,500 credit, buyers will return, I predict. Lower prices, improved charging access, and rising gas costs will outweigh the lost subsidy. EVs will regain momentum by mid-year, pushing sales past 2025 totals. I have to admit, I drive an ID4 electric car, so I'm probably hoping that I made the right decision when I bought it 2 years ago. But I really think the more people ride in them and drive them, they'll realize that it's a superior drive when it comes to just being quiet and when it comes to incredible pickup compared to gas and lower maintenance.
If you're an owner, I'd be curious too. I think from someone like me who's not nearly, doesn't own one, is not as familiar, that to me, one of the concerns would be sort of the build out of charging stations across the country. That's getting better, right?
It is getting better. It's still a concern. Honestly, just yesterday, I was out of town and I planned to charge at this fast charger, and I got there and they were both shut down. They were just off. And I panicked a little because in Wisconsin, it was below zero. But I went on my app and there was one five miles away. So, yes, they're definitely getting built out more. The Trump administration is trying to shut a lot of that down, at least the subsidies. But I think partly the training wheels coming off of electric vehicles might be a good thing. Maybe not subsidizing it and just letting it sell itself will be good, because I don't think a lot of people are going to spend more money just out of the goodness of their heart for the environment. I think what's going to win people over is that the prices are going to keep coming down and that they're really going to be impressed when they ride in one, and batteries are going to get them farther and chargers are going to be more plentiful.
And certainly if there's more EVs on the road, there will be more charging stations built out over time, I would imagine, right?
It's supply and demand. And honestly, when I go to chargers across the Midwest, Illinois and Wisconsin and Minnesota mostly, it's really easy to find one.
Now, Rick, I don't think you have an electric vehicle, but have you come close ever to getting one?
I thought about it. My big concern is here in the Midwest and many of the places I drive, the difficulty of finding charging stations. And then the fact that a lot of the older charging stations take so long. And so as we develop more fast ones, I'd be open to it. I'm not optimistic about a return to former sales within a year. I think it's a longer term. I think it's going to be a very slow ramp up. New car prices are so high. And that's true in the EVs don't maintain their value on the used car market that well. That's a real concern. I mean, like, who's going to buy them? That's my That's my big question, unless we have a lot of really affordable ones and we're not importing the really inexpensive EVs from China. I think that would really open up the market if we, but a lot of the American companies have chosen to make fairly expensive EVs, not the smaller, really inexpensive ones that I think that there'd be much more interest in.
I think you make some great points. I would add, however, that GM just unveiled a $29,000 Chevy. And
yeah, the Bolt, isn't it? The Bolt?
Yes.
Which they used to make and was like a really good car. And then they quit making it. Now they're committing to making it again. I mean, that in itself gives me some reason for concern. Like, why aren't they just committing long-term to this? But who knows?
Yeah, I think most of the companies are, but with an administration that's not just indifferent, but hostile, especially now that Donald Trump has broken with Elon Musk, the electric car maker, with Tesla. I still think, though, that just consumer demand, it just reminds me of those swirly light bulbs. And everybody, a lot of people didn't like those swirly light bulbs because they had some mercury in them. They didn't like the way the light looked. Before you know it, the technology advanced, and we all have LED lights now, and they look great. And I think the same thing is going to happen with EVs, where my ID4 right now, on perfect conditions, I can go 300 miles. Yesterday, I could go only a little over half in Wisconsin when it was below zero. But that battery technology just keeps getting better and better, and kind of like those swirly lights, so light bulbs, we're going to have LED versions of the for a metaphor of electric cars that are just going to go way farther and be more affordable.
And before we move on, you mentioned Elon Musk, and he's sort of an important player here. I mean, he famously has made billions off of Tesla, and Tesla was, you know, a extremely popular company. I think probably up until a couple of years ago, probably more people on the left side of the political aisle were Tesla users because they were embracing the environmental advantages that EVs had. And then all of a sudden, he links arms with Donald Trump, and Tesla sales have dropped. And I think there was a story I read just recently where he sort of was looking back at his whole Doge experience and talked pretty openly about some of the regrets he may have had in that and how he may should have spent more time in his business. And I think also, you know, you can kind of read between the lines, realizing that his political ventures have hurt his business. Do you think, I mean, certainly GM and other companies across the world are embracing EVs, but do you think a couple years from now, Teslas will be kind of disconnected from the political positions that a lot of people associate them with right now?
I think so. Once Trump's out of office, I think things will smooth over for Tesla. But I think it's been a real opening for the other car companies because Tesla was just dominating. And now that they're slipping, some of the other car companies are seeing an opening.
Well, let's continue on with our predictions. We will go back to Rick Kite, who has a prediction. Well, first you had a political prediction. This time it's about our economy, right?
It's about our economy tied to our culture. Because I think we're going to enter sometime in the next year into what I'm calling the AI slop recession. A lot of people are predicting that we're going to have a tech bubble, that because of the overinvestment and the funny like financial stratagems that tech companies are employing to finance these data centers, mainly through private equity and creating really fake companies that keep their debt off the books, right? This is a problem. I think we're going to have that bubble burst at some point. But at the same time, we are entering a period that's really increasing fast where all kinds of AI slop is just hitting us. There's some estimates about 80% of the content on social media is generated in part, at least, by AI. I think we're going to get AI slop in our political campaigns. I think people are going to get so sick of it that it's going to shape an attitude towards AI and the tech industry generally, at the same time that we get a severe hit on our financial markets. And so I think there's going to be a financial and cultural reckoning with AI coming about the same time.
Well, I hope that's not right, because it'll ruin my prediction that electric cars will come back if the economy goes south.
Well, and you mentioned the AI's influence in culture. I don't know if you saw, it was, a couple of weeks ago, where one of the top trending country songs was entirely written, performed, created entirely by AI. And it was top of the charts. And I mean, I think maybe a few people were just curious what it sounded like, but I think a lot of people just probably didn't know, right? And I'm not a music critic. I can't tell you if it was a good country song or not, but it certainly seemed popular. But I think what you're saying is there's going to be a lot of stuff out there that's just kind of garbage. And I think that's true. I think that will also be true. I am less certain, though, that the financial side of this is as maybe risky as you say. And I guess we'll see, right? I think there are a lot of major companies out there who look at this as the ultimate efficiency tool and are looking at ways where some significant investments in this technology can pay some medium to long-term dividends. And that may mean that there's fewer people required of these companies to do the work. It may mean it's done more quickly. I guess we'll wait and see how all that shakes out. But I guess I'm less sure than you are that some of these financial formulas won't work out, and that in fact, there will be still plenty of money to be made in this sector. I mean, I think right now we have a lot of people talking about, is ChatGPT falling a little behind Google Gemini? And in, you know, a few months ago, it was the other way around. I think these companies are extremely competitive. They're run by entrepreneurs who are extremely competitive. And I think these products are going to continue to get better. And I think there are plenty of people in plenty of companies across this country who are looking at ways where they can drive efficiencies through these products. So I think there's still going to be a lot of use there. Again, we'll see how good that turns out for everybody. But I'm less pessimistic on that side of things. From a cultural side, I think there's all sorts of reasons to worry. Scott, where do you land on this?
Yeah, I think as a journalist, I certainly am hopeful that at some point, if it hasn't occurred already, there's a return to appreciation for authenticity. Like other creators, journalists, we go out and we actually talk to people. We go out to the scene and look at the scene. Before, in my job as an opinion journalist, we often meet with the people who are making the decisions on both sides before we weigh in with what we think should happen. And I think there's a value to that, that the mathematical formulas that just put words together, even with fake telemarketing people, I just don't think they can both recreate what, for example, journalism does, but also convince the public that it is the premium product that the public should be after. At least I'm hoping that's the case.
Yeah, no, I certainly second that. And I guess sort of where I want to kind of pivot right back, though, to what Rick started off by saying is he's predicting here a recession, right, that is driven by these questions around AI. And I think it's absolutely true. And there's been some good reporting on this, that if it were not for all the investments being made in sort of these big, widely known companies, you know, building data centers, hiring people at really high salaries and building out this infrastructure, our economy would be pretty stagnant right now. So a lot of the growth we're seeing is around this. And Rick, I think what you're saying is when this sort of falls apart, that is going to really expose sort of the more general weaknesses we have across our economy. Am I paraphrasing your thoughts pretty well?
That's pretty much it. And it's like, so we have all these analysts saying we haven't really seen these kinds of concentration in really highly speculative investments since 2008, and we've got an estimate of $400 billion invested in data centers this year, with the AI companies projected to make around $60 billion. So that's a lot of debt for earnings. A lot of these loans that have been set up are short-term loans, and yet the projections for long-term, like paying back that $400 billion and increased spending going on, it's not like they've already spent it. They're projected to spend in the trillions. Where's that going to come from? And they're all connected with NVIDIA. The other thing that gives me a concern financially is the fact that they're competing with one another for dominance in the market, which makes you think there's going to be winners and losers. But since they're all interconnected in these investments and they're all borrowing from NVIDIA, they're buying chips from NVIDIA and then giving NVIDIA a share of the profits. If any one or two of them fail, the whole thing collapses. So how does that work where they're competing against one another, but they're also highly dependent on all of them being successful? I don't see it being sustainable. I'm not a financial expert. I'm just looking at this from the outside and thinking, this just doesn't make sense to me. I'd be really concerned as an investor.
One thing that could potentially slow it down a bit and hopefully stop it from going over the edge might be that there is a public backlash now to some of these data centers. I know here in by Madison, we have one that's very controversial. Why? It would use as much power as our entire county, which is more than 500,000 people, 2.5 times over potentially. That much energy, according to an environmental county office that did a calculation, and I called the company and they didn't dispute it. I'm not quite sure. I think there's going to have to be some breakthroughs on energy efficiency for just the appetite of energy to keep up with what apparently AI needs. But I do share generally your fear of too many eggs in a basket and too many investors fearing they're missing the next big thing and instead getting too much money into the next big hiccup in the economy.
And before we move on, I just want to stay on that for one more second, if I could, Scott, where you mentioned the siting of these data centers has proved real controversial in communities, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country. It seems to me that on a national level, the Trump administration seems to be very much positioning itself as pro-AI. It's really been supportive in policies that are really meaningful and at the moment, at least, driving some of the growth in that industry. But at the state and local level, especially when it comes to these data centers, I don't get the sense that this is a red versus blue issue, that the people in these communities aren't lining up along those lines. Do you sort of see it the same way I do?
I agree. I think most ordinary people, and I include me myself in that group, they look at AI and they sort of have an existential view of it and say, I don't want AI replacing me in terms of what I do for a job or how I earn income for my family. And there's a natural suspicion to that. Then they want to come into a community and cover up a bunch of farmland with enormous computer servers that are going to use more energy than everybody else has been using. And it doesn't matter if you're conservative or liberal, you're probably going to worry about your utility bills. So yeah, I think this does cross the partisan divide pretty evenly and probably, I don't have polling on it, but a pretty big majority, I suspect, are suspicious.
And I would imagine in state and local races this fall, that will be an issue that candidates will be asked about often.
I would think so. It's already that's why Trump wants to overdo local authority. He's afraid of the locals listening to the local people and putting too many restrictions on what he sees as a great technology that's going to help the economy, I think.
Well, we'll move along and I will make my second prediction for the new year. This is in the health sector. And my prediction is that weight loss drug usage will climb from
estimated 12% of Americans right now to about 18% of American adults by the end of 2026. I think there'll be a few reasons for this. I think manufacturers will continue to expand production, which will ease shortages that we are seeing right now, which will, of course, improve access. And that, I think, is the easier argument to make. I think the trickier argument to make, I think this will kind of hinge on whether my prediction comes true or not, but I think insurers will start to realize that covering the cost, or at least part of the cost, of these GLP-1 drugs will pay off in the medium to long term as expensive diseases such as diabetes and heart disease will, you know, the costs will start to bend lower on that. And there will be pressure from legislators to against some of these insurers to start covering these for the very reason. And of course, the biggest insurance company of all, the United States of America, may also see the advantage in covering some of these when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid. We're not quite there yet, but I think all these pressures will be there. And again, 12% to 18% is a significant jump. I guess, Rick, we'll start with you. Do you think this is, I was going to say a pie in the sky prediction, but maybe we won't be eating pie anymore. So maybe we can't even talk that way.
I think you're generally right. I think like we've unless there's some studies that come out that show that there's side effects that haven't been detected before that are negative to the GLP-1, but everything so far that's come out shows that there's not only no significant adverse health effects, there's all kinds of unanticipated health benefits to taking them. And so I think that makes sense. My only concern is, like, how much are the insurers really concerned about the long-term investment, or are they really more concerned about the short-term? Because, you know, a lot of these health insurance contracts are year-to-year. So anything they can do to save money in the current year might be more important than the long-term health benefits for the insured. I just don't know enough about how the insurance companies work on that, but I think it will increase. I don't know about the insurance companies wanting to pay for it because they think it has long-term benefits.
I think you're right, Scott. I think this is taking off, and you both alluded to other uses. I think it's incredibly exciting, the potential use for alcoholics and other addicts. There's increasingly evidence that this can stem their appetite for drugs and alcohol, not just their appetite for food. So I think there's a lot to these drugs. My only caveat would be, it seems like when medications come out, and I guess the birth control pill comes to mind, is it seems like it's always overprescribed at first, and the medical community eventually finds out, oh, we're actually prescribing a little too much and too high a doses, and there's some side effects that come on that are scary. And so there could be some kind of a short-term backlash if something's discovered along those lines. But generally, I think you're on the mark, Scott. I think rapid growth is the most likely.
One of the things our government is not historically great at is looking to the future and sort of planning for fiscal problems years ahead. But geez, if you're trying to run the Medicaid or the Medicare office and that you're trying to reduce the cost curve, that trying to get people healthier when they start to come on to your program earlier, you would think would be useful. And I would just wonder if there's going to be some, I mean, our present administration does not seem to be too terribly shy about strong arming private companies into doing things that they may not otherwise want to do. And I think in many cases, that's probably not good. But here, if there was a way to sort of talk insurance companies into providing more coverage for these things and better coverage to these things, and I think, as if not more importantly, the manufacturers of these drugs to, you know, increase production so scarcity becomes less of an issue, I think all those things will have a financial benefit to the to our nation as people start to grow older.
Here's one of the things I like about Robert Kennedy, even though I really don't like a lot of the stuff done with immunizations. I think he's correct that like there's profound health benefits to be found in just stop eating processed food, just eat simple foods, eliminate sugars, artificial sweeteners, processed foods, and get regular exercise. And what studies show is you have all those same health benefits as taking GLP-1s. And your food ends up being much more affordable. And so like that would be the simplest, instead of expecting health insurance companies to pony up and the government to pony up for paying for these new drugs. I would like to just see a much more effective campaign to just eat better.
But that's hard, and Americans like easy.
Taking drugs is easy.
That's why I think this is not going to stop because of just the dramatic effects it has on people's appearance and how they feel about themselves. And I just think Americans, I think, you know, I'm going back to my car prediction, but I'm not predicting it because people think they're doing the right thing. I think they're going to start buying electric cars because they're better. And I sort of think, and it's easier and it becomes less costly. And I kind of think with the drugs, that's similar, that a lot of people have tried doing the right thing, or they haven't tried and don't want to and won't. And so this is sort of an incredible thing.
And we've already seen stories, and I think we're going to see more of them in the new year, about how companies like Frito-Lay or McDonald's, and I want to, you know, all the sort of processed food giants are sort of seeing some behavioral changes in about what people are buying, how much people are buying. And I think some of those trends will certainly continue in the new year. Well, we started off this show by making a prediction about politics. Since then, we've covered sports and health and business. But, well, we're going to end with politics. And, Scott, your last prediction is about politics and what we'll be talking about just about 12 months from now.
Well, this is conventional wisdom is going to be my prediction. On the other hand, in the age of Trump, conventional wisdom often ends up being wrong. So I guess I am going out on a limb here and saying that the Democrats will win back the House this fall. Traditionally, historically, that's what happens when a president faces a midterm election, when it's not a very popular president, which Trump isn't. And when the economy is a little shaky, or at least people think it is, or that things are costing too much. And it appears the Democrats, for a change, have a very clear message. It's affordability, about health care in particular, but also basic food and utilities and other things. And it looks like they're going to hammer home this message. They're going to win back the House, despite all of the competing gerrymandering attempts, some of which are failing and some of which are not. But my big one caveat is I think we won't know that the Democrats have won. There's only about 30 seats in play in the 435 seat House. So it's very few seats are in play. So I think it will still be close. It'll be enormous legal challenges in multiple states that will go to state Supreme Courts and maybe even the U.S. Supreme Court to ultimately decide a couple of them. So I'm also predicting not just that the Democrats win, but we won't know that they will have won by the time you try to fact check me next year.
And just to make sure we put a fine point on this, you're predicting the Democrats will win the U.S. House. You think that they will not retake the U.S. Senate. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not predicting that. I think that's a little tougher given some of the races they're facing. But the House seems to be easier, and the House tends to move back and forth in bigger sweeps, particularly in midterm elections.
Well, Rick, your prediction earlier was that we're going to enter a recession, and a recession is never good for the party in power. And Republicans right now not only hold the executive branch, but the House and the Senate. Do you think Scott's prediction sounds pretty good?
Even Republicans know this, right? Like, it's the president isn't really popular face in a midterm. The other party's going to do much better. I wonder about the legal. I think there will be those legal challenges, but that would only be in the really close races. Am I right, Scott? And so, like, how many of those races do you think will be that close that it would really hold up knowing the results of the election?
Well, just even think of the last election. There were a handful we were waiting for weeks, is my recollection, in places like California. And some states allow ballots to be counted after they arrive, after the election, several days, as long as they're postmarked. And there, and one thing we've learned in Wisconsin is you can challenge some very narrow decisions made by election clerks. So I'm not saying that these challenges will stick, but I don't see Trump graciously saying the Democrats have won. I see him saying to stop the steal again, even though it's not a steal, if it isn't. I think there could be, for a while, 10, 15 seats being contested.
And you do remind me that in the last, a year ago now, we had some parts of California, although it was not going to affect the outcome of even a congressional race, let alone the presidency. But there were some parts of California that were counting into December, it seemed. And it just seemed, we just need to do better with that, right? I mean, people make fun of Florida for lots of good reasons, but they know how to count votes down there. I mean, you watch an election night and it's like, yeah, there may be 1% missing from some oddball part of the state, but like almost everything is in within like a few hours of poll closing. And there are some lessons that Florida and probably some other states I'm forgetting could teach states like California about how to count.
Oh, definitely. And even here in Wisconsin, we still haven't fixed these late night ballots coming in from Milwaukee County. Now, the Milwaukee County congressional seat is not going to be in play, so that won't be an issue this fall. But in presidential races, unless we change that and let them start counting the absentee ballots before the day of the election, we will continue to have Milwaukee County, our largest county, counting through the night, which looks suspicious, even though it isn't. So I think a lot of states, including my own, need to improve how they do things.
Well, I think those are six good predictions. We, as Scott mentioned, I'll be in charge of copying those down and putting them into a file and looking at them about this time next year, and we will see how well we did. And that is exactly what I did do, because as loyal listeners to this show may remember, Tim Kelly, who is our company senior manager for central audience and strategy, joined us on last year's prediction show. Before we wrap, I'd like to revisit some of those predictions and see how well Tim's, Rick's, and my forecasts held up.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Rick, we'll start with your two predictions. First, you predicted that 10 states will pass laws banning cell phones in schools. Well, I mean, the only thing wrong with your prediction, Rick, is you underestimated that. There was great momentum, and that has been about as big of a bipartisan trend that we have seen across this nation. You nailed that, and many more than 10 passed such policies.
And I think my impression is that there's many more schools are planning to implement that in the year going in the next year, either this next semester after the Christmas break or then next year. And then we probably all heard the news about Australia banning social media accounts just last week for anybody under 16. And so there's a real momentum now to push these bans. I think what's going to be fascinating coming up in the next year or two is looking at the data. Like, do we notice any improvements in the mental health or in learning outcomes for teens?
Looking at your other prediction from last year, Rick, you suggest, and we touched on this a little bit in the show today, in fact, that utility prices will soar due to demand from AI and cryptocurrency. From what I looked into this, and please tell me if I'm wrong, is I learned that energy costs did rise in many places, but most experts do not blame AI or crypto at this moment. At least that's not the dominant cause of those increases, Rick. And do you have a reason to tell me I'm wrong?
Well, I consulted AI, and a number of AI sources, including Gemini, said that the AI data centers are the major cause. They listed about five or six other ones, too.
Okay. But
the first one, all the AI sources I consulted, the first cause of rising energy prices was AI.
Well, I'm not going to argue with AI saying it's responsible for that, so I'll give you a 2 for 2 in predictions, Rick, which on this show is about as good as you can get. And on my next two predictions, I will promise we're not nearly as good as Rick's. I optimistically predict that autonomous taxi rides would climb to 3% of all U.S. rides. Robo-taxis have continued to expand, and in fact, they're even going to some markets up north, including Minneapolis here in the new year. But that 3% figure was way, way too high. Companies like Waymo are still a very small sliver of that market. Although I would encourage everybody to read a terrific op-ed a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times that basically said we should look at the expansion of autonomous driving as a public health priority, because already we have shown that autonomous vehicles are remarkably safer compared to like people like any of us on or anybody listening, and that we are really that is something that we could invest more in and have some strong public health outcomes with, which is really kind of a different way to look at that. So that 3% was wrong, but we're moving in the right direction. I also predicted vertical farming would surge to be a $10 billion global market. Again, sort of the same story here. The industry grew, but not quite to that scale. And part of the reason was high energy costs hurt profitability in some of these large vertical farming operations. Real quick before we close, Tim Kelly is not with us today, but he had a couple of AI predictions last year, one about a significant breakthrough in medicine or science. It's hard to say, but I could not find a hugely significant breakthrough, although there have been significant advances in diagnostics and discovery and modeling, but I don't think there was that one headline grabbing thing that just kind of made everybody realize that this is going to be a game changer. I don't know if any of you disagree on that.
No, I think you may be being too kind to your boss, Tim Kelly.
That may be true. And Tim's very other, very intelligent, well thought out prediction was that AI will be weaponized to significantly disrupt everyday life. You know, there were obviously deep fakes and cyber attacks and digital threats all intensified. But I don't know, but I wonder if Tim was thinking that there would be some like large scale blackout or long-term internet outage or something that would make us all unable to for days not access our banks or other key infrastructure. And that did not happen. Obviously, we're happy about that, but it will be interesting to see as we get these things continue to be more interconnected if that prediction may come true someday. So we hope not, but please stand by.
Just to back Tim up, though, on one point with AI, when I go to my doctor now, AI takes the notes for him and the doctor doesn't. And it seems like I get to talk to my doctor more, and the doctor seems like the doctor has more time. So I'm not sure that that's as significant as Tim was predicting. But from a patient standpoint, I like it.
That is a good point, because we much rather have our physicians be, well, physicians and not stenographers. So that's probably a move in the right direction. Scott, Rick, thanks for joining us. This was fun, and we will, as always, hold you all accountable come this time next year.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column, which is more often than not about ethics. He doesn't make too many predictions in there. And those columns can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite and Scott Milfred, I'm Scott Rada. Thanks for listening, and we wish you all a happy new year.